Welcome to Apropos of Something. This is 94.7 WPVC Resistance Radio, Persistence Radio, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We air every Saturday morning from 10 to 11, co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio, and Nancy Lawrence from our studio in New York City. We seek out the most interesting people we can find with a passion for social justice, political activism, and the arts, and we guarantee every show will be apropos of something. As always, we are grateful for the sponsorship of the Beckham team at Keller Williams Realty. Today, we are talking to Dr. Cameron Webb and author Hannah Barnaby. Webb is an assistant professor of medicine at the University of Virginia School of Medicine. He was awarded a prestigious White House fellowship where he worked on policies to improve lives of black boys and men. Today, we'll get a window into his unique perspective at the intersection of health and social justice and how it informs his leadership in the health equity movement. And we also welcome Hannah Barnaby, author of young adult and children's books, including Garcia and Colette Go Exploring. She was the first children's writer in residence at the Boston Public Library. She's a former editor and was a Morris Award finalist for her debut novel, Wonder Show. She lives and teaches here in Charlottesville. As a reminder, you can check out all our past shows on the station website. We have 42 or so shows at 947wpvc.org. And if you want to throw down a few dollars to help us get a better microphone for Nancy, better equipment for us, please feel free to do that there, too. Speaking of the phone line, Nancy, are you there, my friend?
Yeah,
great.
Yeah, I really need that microphone ASAP. No, I hope I'm here. Am I here? Tell me, am I there?
Yes. Yes.
So we're in our 40s. Ellen, we're having... We might be having a mid-show crisis.
We definitely
had one. Do we need to do one in a red convertible or something? Is that coming in our future?
Yes, yes. I've had many...
Well, we need more budget then, not the microphone. We need to raise money for the car we're going to drive around in for this... anyway, I'm sorry.
Yeah, anyway.
I'm done.
Can I get intellectual here just for a moment?
I thought I was, but fine.
The NRA, Wayne LaPierre, and Trump, what a-holes... And S-holes, people that they are and organizations that they are. I've never said that before on the air. But they made me just more mad than usual this week, I must say. The Conservative Crap Greed Action Conference, Trump led boos against John McCain. He encouraged the lockup chant for Clinton. And the whole audience, you know, they are part of it, too. The whole crowd, the group mentality thing.
Yeah, I know. I'm hoping. They are frightened by those students. They are giving me chills up my spine, and I am incredibly cynical. But they've already affected, apparently, Oregon passed some gun legislation yesterday that the governor even happily actually, attributed some of that momentum to those kids.
Fantastic.
It is, I know, even as I say it, I swear they're just amazing.
Mm-hmm.
But just to throw some water on your NRA, I know, they're astounding.
No, let's talk about the positives.
Out of the window.
Yeah, I mean, Emma Gonzalez, when I first heard that speech, it was amazing. Just the raw emotion. I heard someone else, I didn't know his name, but just how articulate and, true. Like, they're just extremely, earnest, and it's
right.
Great to hear.
Right. They have no, they don't have the baggage of adulthood yet, and they are so energetic. I mean, they won't take it. And the more, first they're young enough or they're old enough to date Roy Moore, and then they're too young to have an opinion. I'm sure that only in sparks them to just do what they want to do. I mean, they're at the perfect age to just not take anyone's advice that's
right.
older.
I mean, they've lived through all these shootings. And the fact that Cittadini had to have crib notes to say, that's just disgusting. And I think our only hope is the teenagers voting and Mueller. Last Friday, it was 13 indictments, 3 Russian companies. This week, we got Gates and Manafort. I don't know. I haven't heard enough about how Manafort is probably a Russian spy because he has no fear.
What the amount of creative bookkeeping that guy has been doing for, you know, at least a decade is astounding. You know, I feel like the indictment list is only going to grow on, you know, and I feel like we should have like a Mueller indictment fantasy league or something, you know, like they're just, so many of them, yeah. You know, there's just so many of them. And he is, I mean, I guess that's why, you know, criminals are not, they do what they do because they're just not smart enough to cover their tracks.
Well,
I mean,
he couldn't convert a Word document to a PDF. That was the paper
right,
trail, the email trail.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. So there have been 100 criminal counts. You said there's a lot against 19 people, three companies. And of the 19 people, four, including three, are include three Trump associates, and they've all pleaded, pleaded guilty. Yeah. I'm already reenacting the horrible election party with the same group of people so that we can kind of, you know, recuperate from that and celebrate the Mueller, the takedown, basically.
Yeah, if only we could just fold the calendar so that November could come fast enough. It would, you know, because how much can, anyway, who knows what can happen between then and now. But I, as much as I hate winter, I wish it was coming around again, I have to say.
So speaking of all this stuff, there are walkouts and marches in response to that February shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas.
Yep.
So March 24th, March for Our Lives, March on Washington with sister marches around the country. And then the 20th of April, which is the 19th anniversary of the massacre at Columbine, there will be walkouts. And I know at least one high school in Texas is punishing the students for doing that, which is so disgusting.
Yeah, there's also that one on March 14th where they're all just for 17 minutes, they're going to, you know, demanding gun safety, but they're going to leave their schools. I know the big one, I believe, is, as you said, March 24th, but there's a national school walkout on the 14th. And then on the 5th, can't forget March 5th. That's when Trump's self-imposed DACA deadline ends. They're doing a march in D.C., but the Women's March is hosting it. It's enough. It's called Enough Political Games, Protect Immigrant Youth Now. And with his decision to end DACA, 20,000 immigrant youth have already lost their jobs and protections. And after that deadline, 1,000 more will be losing them every week. Mm-hmm. And none of them have criminal indictments, 800,000 of them.
Of course they don't. Yeah. That's the whole point.
Yeah.
I also wanted to mention a film going around here. I'm Not Racist, Am I? There have been lots of showings. There are going to be three more that I know of, Monday, February 26th at Crozet Library at 8:30. I wanted to just say what it's about. It follows 12 New York City high school students of different backgrounds for 1 year as they complete a series of workshops and discussions all about race and privilege. I finally saw it. It was really, really, really really good. If you think you have nothing left to learn, you have a lot. There's a lot to learn. So again, this Monday, February 26th at the Crozet Library at 8:30. March 6th, Northside Library, 8:30. This is Charlottesville. March 16th, the Jefferson School African American Heritage Center at 9 o'clock. So we have an amazing show today. Our first guest is Dr. Cameron Webb. Webb is an assistant professor of medicine at the University of Virginia School of Medicine. He's a UVA alumnus and Eccles Scholar. He earned a law degree and a health law certificate from Loyola University Chicago School of Law and an MD from Wake Forest School of Medicine. He was appointed to the 2016-17 class of White House Fellows, where he worked on policies to improve the lives of Black boys and men. Today, we will get a window into his very unique perspective at the intersection of health and social justice and how it informs his leadership in the health equity movement. Welcome to the show, Cameron.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yes, it's our pleasure. So what is the focus of your research?
Well, my research is pretty broad-reaching right now. You know, I think a lot of it is focused on health policy and understanding that there's a lot of health equity work to be accomplished in health policy. And so, you know, I always talk about health policy in kind of three spaces, the three different parts of a triangle, if you will. And so there's cost, access, and quality. And so I do a lot of work in access on Medicaid and some of the work that we need to do to improve that program and make sure that we're giving access to some of the most vulnerable folks in the country. In the cost space, I mean, you know, Charlottesville has the highest insurance premiums in the country. And so, you know, that's something that we're working on. And then in the quality space, that's where I work specifically on social determinants of health. health and health equity, which is one of the six domains of quality that kind of have been identified. And so that's kind of where my research lives. And I think my heart is really in the social determinants work, just understanding that your health is determined much more by where you're born, grow, live, learn, eat, play, and pray than what we do in the hospital. So, yeah.
And did your time in the White House come from that? How did you wind up in the White House working as a fellow, as a doctor there? What were you doing there? How'd you wind up there?
Yeah, I mean, the White House Fellowship was created in 1964. It's kind of a mid-career leadership program. And so I applied for it after my third year of residency. I did my residency training in internal medicine at Cornell in New York City. And so afterward, I decided, you know, let me give this a try. It's the only chance I'll get to work in the White House for President Obama. And so I applied, and it's a lengthy process. And, you know, by God's grace, I got it. And so, you know, when I started the fellowship, working in the Obama administration, I worked on My Brother's Keeper, which was the president's initiative to improve life outcomes for boys and young men of color. And I also worked on the White House healthcare team. And so we were working on implementing some aspects of the Affordable Care Act. And then, you know, after the election and then subsequently the inauguration, I continued working in the White House in the Trump administration. And I, you know, my portfolio shifted significantly, I'll say, but I worked primarily on healthcare policy.
So can you tell us why Obama created the My Brother's Keeper initiative? What are some of the problems?
Well, you know, if you hear the president tell it, you know, I still refer to him that way. You
yes.
know, I think a lot of it was Trayvon Martin. And it was kind of in the wake of that. He asked some of his staff, what can we do to address these things? His heart had always been in that work. And so he decided, you know, let's create a program, an initiative around improving life outcomes for boys and young men of color. And they really focused around a couple of issues. So first and foremost was mentorship and making sure that there was a great mentor infrastructure for boys and young men of color. Education was a key component. Work, and so kind of making sure that young folks have the opportunity to work and have jobs that are available for them and that they're well trained for. And then the last piece is criminal justice reform. You know, he focused a lot on second chances and talked about the overcriminalization of black boys and men across the country and how, you know, if they've been arrested or incarcerated and they've paid their debt to society, they should have the chance to live a full and productive life.
Just to follow up on that, you had mentioned that our access to health care has a lot more to do with where we've come from. That can you explain that?
Sure. Well, I mean, to put it plainly, your health outcomes have a lot more to do with your zip code than your genetic code. You know, in the wake of the Human Genome Project over the last 20 years, we've learned so much about genes, and we found that within a race, there's more variation in your genes than there's the variation between the races, right? And so it's pretty incredible. But if you look at zip codes across the country, the life expectancy gap, I mean, you know, in some communities, it's 68 years, and others, it's 88 years, right? And so the fact that there's that big of a spread based on zip code tells us a lot more about our society than we knew. And so then you do the deep dive into, well, what are those factors? And it's things like education, transportation, land use and zoning, the retail food environment, so many different pieces that a community is shaped by. And those, if you go upstream, are shaped by structural inequality and racism. So, you know, I think it's understanding the factors that created these inequitable communities.
Yeah, one of the, I will let you jump in, Nancy. I just wanted to say one thing about that film that stood out to me. The definition of racism was discrimination and power. So looking at the institutional, you know, the structural and institutional racism, it's not that you're nice to people or being mean is not, doesn't say that you're racist. Being nice doesn't mean you're not racist. So it's this power structure that is very oppressive to minorities and black people.
Well, and I completely agree. And I like the paradigm that there's a Dr. Kamara Jones, who was the president of the American Public Health Association. But she has this paradigm that she uses, really the three pieces of what racism is. And there's your institutionalized racism. That's the environment that we live in. That's the structures that are created that are racist by nature. There's personally mediated, and that's your discrimination and your stereotyping. That's, you know, people acting on those thoughts or just, you know, having those thoughts in general. And then there's the internalized racism. That's the part, you know, she describes it as the white man's ice is colder. The fact that, you know, if you've really taken in this racism over the course of your lifetime and you're in a tough spot, let's say you're in the hospital, you may look at me and not want me to be your doctor because you're like, hey, I'm really sick and I don't know if a black doctor's going to cut it, you know? Or you've been arrested and you're like, I need to get the white lawyer because he may be the one who can get me off. The fact that that happens, and we've seen it happen in our society, that's racism at play. And so our work has to be in addressing all of these different forms of racism.
I know it's hardly new, racism, and how it affects patients' health care. I am curious if you think, has it gotten, in the short time he's been president, has it gotten worse since people now say and do much more out loud than they ever did before?
You know, I anecdotally, I can't say that's been my experience. You know, I came from practicing in New York City, which is very different than practicing in Charlottesville, Virginia. And so, you know, a lot of the differences that I see are just regional differences. But you know, I think that there's certainly a Trump effect. I think that people do find some gratification or some enjoyment out of being able to speak without necessarily considering how it impacts others. And so, you know, that can play out in any of a number of environments. And, you know, I've certainly faced racial epithets in my time here in Charlottesville, and I've also dealt with some really great patients. So I think it's not all a Trump effect, but I think that you know certainly plays a part.
You mentioned that, and it just reminds me you did have an experience, at least one that I know of. I'm sure you've had others. Can you talk a little bit? Do you mind talking about that? What happened here?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it was my fourth day working in Charlottesville, and for me, you know, I was going to see a patient in the emergency department, and you know, after a couple minutes in the conversation, he remarked that he thought he knew me from somewhere, and I told him that he didn't. And ultimately he said, oh, that's right. You're the N-word who used to hang out in Jimmy's backyard. And he was an elderly man. He was confused at the time. But, you know, the takeaway that I had was, you know, the fact that he was able to use that word in an interaction with a doctor just told me a lot about how often and how comfortably he'd used it throughout his lifetime. And so I wrote a piece about it and talked about the responsibility we all have just to have those conversations with our loved ones when they're completely copus mentis, when they're with it and they're able to talk to us and they understand, hey, we can't talk and think like that anymore, because when we don't have our full faculties, that's when our, you know, these beliefs and these thoughts are really going to come out.
Mm-hmm.
Cameron, what do you think about how the GOP and Trump are trying to, you know, in their own way, dismantle the ACA, you know, to make it more difficult for everyone to get coverage?
Yeah, well, I mean, the first thing I'll say is that's not their goal. You know, they're not trying to make it more difficult for anybody to get coverage. This is a classic case of people thinking that they're going to do more good, but just not having the full insight into how the consequences of their course of action is going to do more harm. And so, I mean, in some instances, there certainly are people who don't care that it's going to do harm. But I think more often than not, it's an ignorance factor. It's just a lack of awareness of how things really play out in communities of color and vulnerable communities. And so, you know, in the access front, they actually think that people are going to get more access if you use the market to make it cheaper. And they think that the Obama administration misunderstood the economics of healthcare, and they would need to let the market dictate how this plays out. And we know that healthcare doesn't perform like a normal market. And so, you know, some of it is just a misunderstanding or just lack of thoughtfulness and caring and really wanting to adhere to that ideological, let's have the market play out here. But, you know, there certainly is a lot of sentiment where it's, you know, not necessarily top of mind how it affects vulnerable communities.
You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is Apropos of Something. We're speaking with Dr. Cameron Webb. He's a health equity leader. We'll be right back. We're also going to talk with Hannah Barnaby. Stay tuned. Welcome back, everyone. This is Apropos of Something. We air every Saturday from 10 to 11. We're speaking with Dr. Cameron Webb. He's an assistant professor of medicine at the University of Virginia School of Medicine. And Cameron, you do a lot with, you were a White House fellow, as we talked about, which is a prestigious appointment only for leaders and people who have had a lot of experience doing the work that you're doing. Can you tell us about the policies now, what your view is, and what do you think is important to talk about with regard to policy?
Oh, man, we'd need an hour and a half to cover that. I mean, you know, I write a blog every week on the activities in health policy, and yeah, I'm amazed at just how much content there is from day to day in what's happening in health policy. And so, you know, there's certainly a lot. Like I mentioned, I use the framework of access, quality, and cost. But, you know, when I'm talking about social determinants and when I'm talking about some of the threats to communities of color and vulnerable communities, you know, I think a lot about just what we've seen in the last 2 weeks. So, you know, from, you know, threats to supplemental nutrition assistance or
SNAP.
Yeah. So threats to SNAP and threats to Medicaid programs across the country. Here in Virginia, we're having a robust discussion about what to do with Medicaid, and we still haven't expanded our program here. So there's a lot. There's definitely a lot to dig into.
So what are your thoughts about this latest proposal to replace food stamps with these boxes of canned goods, or what, you know, the government deciding what you should eat?
Well, I laugh because my first thought is comparing it to Blue Apron was about as tone deaf as you can get. Yeah. So there's that. But I do think that you know, I always try to put myself. I worked in the Trump administration for 6 months, so I try to think like, what are they actually thinking when they're rolling this out? And with that, I believe there was somebody who's sitting in a room somewhere who said, how can we make sure that everybody's getting healthy food? But I think they forgot that how can we give people the dignity of having choice in their food? And how can we change the retail food environments in some of these communities so that people have access to healthier foods? And how can we get access to you know, farm-to-table foods or farmers markets for people who have, you know, low resources from an income standpoint? You know, they focus solely on that end product. And so, yeah, I mean, I think it's a bad idea, but I think there are no details to it right now. So what I was telling my class the other day was, you know, if you're upset about this idea and it makes you angry, understand we've got lots of opportunities to engage about it before it affects anybody. So let's use them.
What do you suggest?
Well, I think for starters, you know, if they want to do something along those lines, they should start with saying, well, what are the pieces that aren't going to be less healthy options for folks? Let's make sure we're preserving a large amount of the SNAP benefits where they can still go into stores and buy the items that they want and need. One of the big issues with food insecurity is that people simply aren't eating food. And so we know if you just give somebody a box full of items, a lot of that's going to go unused or go returned or be traded for other items. And so let's think about this in a way that actually navigates people and communities the right way. And I think they need to have the right voices at the table. We have food insecurity experts in all of our communities around the country and folks who do this work, and they should be the ones helping guide this policy.
It's obvious that they're not looking at research.
Well, that's a habit that they have in some of these areas. So you know, the one that really comes to mind is the Medicaid work requirements, and you know, there's so much research on work requirements and whether they have an impact, and whether the people on Medicaid who aren't working, if it's because they simply don't want to. And I think they're letting the narrative control rather than actually looking at a lot of the mountain of evidence that we have. But remember, this is an administration that came to power kind of decrying some of the science that's out there. And so they have a huge skepticism about some of the evidence that we use.
Because it suits their racist views.
Yeah, I mean,
in my opinion,
I think it's because, you know, for some that may be the case. I think for others, it's just because they've seen evidence play out in so many different ways and they just pick their evidence, you know. And the old adage in politics was, you know, you can pick your argument, but you can't pick your facts. And here you actually can pick your facts. And this is something that's happened to our society at large. I mean, if you look on Facebook, if you look anywhere, I mean, you just see so many different versions of the truth. And if you put that in an environment that's filled with racism or hatred or stereotyping or preconceived notions, and you give them a menu of facts to choose from, well, they're going to choose the facts that already suit their argument. And so I think that's going to play out. And I don't think that's only something that can play out in this administration. It can play out anywhere in our society. And I think we kind of as the people have to be very vigilant and have to say, how can we protect against that? How can we be the arbiter of what's true and what's accurate and call for some version of facts, you know?
I agree, but I just think there is such a laser focus on the underserved community, and that's why I was listening to your answer, but I do think they're, just like with the work requirements and the food stamps turning into wasteful delivery of boxes and the money that's just misdirected, I do feel like they are making those that need health insurance, they're just making it harder for everyone to qualify, harder for everyone to get covered. Those short-term health plans, you know, that they are now somehow proposing because of the way they're dealing with the health insurance now, the ACA. What are your feelings about those short-term health plans that they're now cropping up as alternatives so people don't sign up for ACA?
Right. So short-term, limited-duration insurance, from my perspective, it's a bad idea, right? The Obama administration shortened that duration from just under a year down to 3 months because, you know, as a lot of folks have described it, these are junk plans, right? It's not the kind of meaningful, valuable, continuous insurance that helps improve people's access to care. And again, this is where we know that, but their emphasis is more on people having choice and people spending the money they want to spend. And, you know, this is America, and so there are some people who think that in America you should be able to choose how you spend your money. What's different about healthcare is that we realize that people navigate it very differently. It's not that you might become sick. It's that everybody becomes a patient at some point in time. And the way that we invest in that on the front end has to be different. And kind of going back to your earlier point, you know, what I'll say is working in the Trump administration, you know, some days it was a lot harder than others. It's terrifying walking out of the White House to a group of protesters and saying, I don't feel that way. I don't agree. But, you know, at the same time, you know, I use that time to really learn how they think. And when it comes to vulnerable populations and when it comes to low income communities, what they actually think is these people are victims of circumstance to some extent, but that they too can climb their way out of poverty if government just doesn't get in their way. And that's the argument I've had so many times with them, that's not the case. That's actually not what we're seeing. They're so keyed into that ideology that's what we're seeing play out in these policies.
Right, right. That is, I've heard that too, and it's so infuriating. What is the way? I mean, I think film is a great way to, and books. I mean, what kind of tools, just the average person who has an in-law, a parent, a friend who believes that, to help change minds or influence, show what's really going on?
I agree with you. I think film has been tremendous, and I have to applaud some of the folks in Hollywood, which hasn't been particularly socially active in its history, but I think, you know, some of the focus that we're seeing in some of the films that have been coming out in the last few years has really depicted poverty and the circumstances of certain communities in a different way. And it shows you that this just isn't people who just don't want better or people who are choosing to live with government assistance. There are communities that are designed to trap people there, you know. And what the other part of it is just, you know, telling the true history of America. We have this habit of changing our history so that it suits us and so that it offends fewer people. But the reality is our history is ugly and it's hurtful and it's painful. And if we turn to it and face it and we use the different media that we have, whether it's books or television or movies, you know, I think we can really create some change. And then the last is just the public discourse. I think the better we as a public do of really engaging and telling the stories of our communities, you know, here in Charlottesville, telling the story of Vinegar Hill, like telling the stories of the places that were really tragically decimated to serve a purpose, but that created the conditions that we see today. You know, you tell those stories and you make sure that people hear them, and I think you can start to create some change.
What health disparities do you feel are the most egregious and the most fixable, you know, are there any on either side?
So when I think of health disparities, I define that as the differences in health outcomes. And so the most egregious one to me is just the differences in infant mortality. you know, it makes no sense that a black mother with the same education level as a white mother in some communities has four times the infant mortality rate. And it has very little to do with, you know, genetic predisposition. It has a lot to do with preterm and early birth. And so there are some great community organizations here in Charlottesville that work on that very issue. But, you know, things like that, you know, if you know, what we've learned in the life course is that when an infant is born premature, you're already starting them off with a health deficit. And that accrues over a lifetime. And it turns into so many other health problems. And you know, just giving people a start that's behind the starting line in this race of life just doesn't make sense. So that one really hits home for me. I think there's a ton of work to do in HIV and AIDS, both here and abroad. And I think that that's something that we can work on and we can spend a lot more time on. And everything else, I like to describe the cardiovascular disease disparities, heart attacks and heart failure or diabetes. That's kind of a combination of what we see in our community. So that's the food environment. That's where I really dig in, because I say we can fix this if we just acknowledge that we created it, you know? And so, so my answer to you is probably all of them, but I think there's a ton of work to do, and we have to be equal to that task.
Wow. Well, you're amazing. Thank you for being here. Where can people read your blog, Dr. Cameron Webb?
It's on the UVA Public Health Services website. So it's a really long URL.
Okay.
But if they just Googled Viewpoints UVA or Public Health Sciences Viewpoints UVA, they would find the blog. And I'd love to have more people following it.
Actually, we'll put it on the website, the apropos WPVC.org, 947 WPVC.org website. Thank you so much for being here, Cameron Webb.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Hey, Nance, how you doing?
Yes. Well, you know, I was just thinking, what an amazing way to, you know, use your time to just help people. It's to such an extent. It's amazing. So my news of note, my news of note is not such a downer this time, in fact.
Where's my applause? My applause.
I know.
Wait. I can get it.
Okay.
Oh, wait, you can barely hear it.
Well, I think,
You can barely hear it.
I appreciate the backup. It is first that the Supreme Court wouldn't let Pennsylvania Republicans hold off on drawing a new congressional map, and it was Justice Alito that issued that order. That happened first, and then this week on Monday, the Pennsylvania High Court issued its new congressional district map, declaring the current one unconstitutional, and this ensures that Democratic prospects will hopefully improve dramatically. They have more Democrats registered in Pennsylvania than Republicans, and yet Republicans have 13 with that funky map, with 13 of the 18 seats. It's one of the most gerrymandered has been, and now it's redrawn, and hopefully, I do think I read that there's another lawsuit coming from the GOP lawmakers, but it's already been tossed out by the Supreme Court and now the state court. And anyway, that is my news of note, that there is a new map in Pennsylvania.
I know. I heard a little bit about that. And I'm so excited for the blue wave.
Whoa.
The blue wave that's coming. You know what I'm talking about? The Democratic blue wave. So I was really happy to hear that also. You finally got the joke. Okay. There's a delay. So my news of note is that James Buchanan is no longer the worst president ever considered by Americans.
Cannot imagine who's in that position. I just, whoa.
So in 2000,
killing me.
I know. A 2018 presidential greatness survey, an online poll responded to by Republicans, Democrats, and independents, blah, 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 determined, of course, that it was Trump. And it was interesting.
The man who knows how to listen? I can't believe it.
And it was Buchanan. Do you know why Buchanan was considered to be the worst?
I think because he didn't do anything and we had a civil war.
Yeah.
Something.
You're amazing. You get an A for poli-sci today.
He was, for not. Go ahead.
He just had indifference about the onset of the civil war, which is pertinent. It relates to Trump, I think. You can draw your own conclusions.
Yeah. Totally.
So with no further ado, I wanted to introduce our next guest. She is Hannah Barnaby, Barnaby is an award-winning author of young adult and children's books. She was the first children's writer in residence at the Boston Public Library. She's a former editor and was a Morris Award finalist for her debut novel, Wonder Show. She has an MA in children's literature from Simmons College and an MFA in writing for children and young adults from Vermont College. She lives and teaches right here in Charlottesville, and she'll be speaking at the Virginia Festival of the Book, March 21 through 23 at various locations. Welcome to Apropos of Something, Hannah.
Thank you so much for having me.
So when did you first feel like you were really a writer?
A couple weeks ago.
Really?
No. That is a question that I'm still figuring out how to answer that. So lots of writers will say, like, oh, I always wanted to be a writer. I kind of ran in the opposite direction from it for a long time. So I did all these jobs around writing, jobs that involved writing. Almost every job I've ever had has been related to books in some way. But it was not until truly pretty recently, like maybe 5 or so years ago, that I really was able to say, answer that question when people said, you know, what do you do? That I could say I'm a writer and own that.
So before we ask you about the books you've written, I am a little curious what you can share about the, you know, your process. And I apologize if you don't even think of it that way. But what is that like for you? I'll stop right there. What is that like for you, Hannah?
So it kind of depends on what I'm working on. Novels are very different than picture books, as you might imagine. You know, a novel text might be 100,000 words. One of my picture books is about 200 words. So it's a wildly different pursuit. The scope of the story is very different. And then whether or not there are illustrations in play is a totally different process. So I love working in multiple forms because it allows me to kind of adjust my bandwidth. Like if there's a lot going on at home, I can kind of noodle around with a picture book in a way that I can just dip in and out of it. And that's harder to do with a novel. I tend to work on novels more when I can get away on a retreat or when I have a block of time that's really open. And then it's a lot of, my friends and I joke, we do a lot of our writing doesn't look like writing. It's like walking the dog or washing the dishes or folding the laundry or baking or, you know, being on Facebook. We like to say we're always thinking about it in the back of our mind. The amount of time we actually spend, you know, putting words on paper is probably not as much as you would think.
Do you get a lot of inspiration from those tasks or from your family?
I don't get inspiration from folding the laundry generally, but although I'm sure every
just
picture,
watch. every picture book
writer has been like, I could write a story about where all those missing socks end up. No, it's more like distracting your brain and letting that door swing open a little bit. So, you know, it's like peripheral vision. I tend to think of my writing as peripheral vision.
We're going to go to a break and we'll be right back with author Hannah Barnaby. Welcome back, everyone. Our theme music brought to you by, I don't know, the album's called This Is the End. I need to say that every once in a while. And I do think that that has something to do with what's been going on in this country. But it gets a little wonky, Nance, towards the end of the cut. You notice that?
Is that indicative of what's going to be happening with this administration, perhaps?
Yes.
Anyway.
Perfect. Well, let's continue talking with Hannah Barnaby. Hey, Nancy, why don't you continue?
I would. I would like to. Hannah, when you write, whether or not it's different every time, but is your first draft, how different is it from the final?
Sometimes extremely different. When I first wrote Wonder Show, so that was drafted at the Boston Public Library. I was doing a residency there. And the terms of the residency were basically like that they would, you know, provide me with some funding and an office space. And I had to spend 20 hours a week there and turn in a finished draft at the end. But there was no indication of what they would do with the finished draft at the end. And I'm thank God they didn't do anything with it because it was pretty terrible. And I, you know, printed it all out and I like tied it up with a ribbon and I put it in a box and I gave it to them. And it, and then I didn't look at it again for like 6 months until someone, an editor got in touch with me and said, hey, whatever happened to that, that book you were working on? And I was like, oh, it's, yeah, you can see it. Let me just, give it another look. And I went back to it and was like, oh my God, this is crazy. It's like full of holes. It makes no sense. There's basically no plot. It was a, I wrote it all out of order. For people who are aspiring novelists, I do not recommend writing a novel completely out of chronological order. And so that the finished book of Wonder Show is so different than the first draft. But then with something like a picture book, I might only change a few words because I have to have a pretty good idea of what the structure is going to be before I get started on the actual writing. And I do a lot of kind of pre-writing where I think about the structure, where I think about the plot, you know, sort of where's the beginning, where's the ending, and the middle is usually a little less defined. And so picture books are easier for me to, you know, kind of keep in my head all at once. Novels are very, very difficult to do that with. And so often novels will, I won't really have a sense of what the book is about until I sort of reach near the end of the first draft. And there's usually an aha moment where I'm like, oh, that's what I've been trying to get at. And then I have to go back to the beginning and make it all line up.
Which book do you like talking about the most?
Probably Wonder Show. I mean, it's sort of like my first baby.
Can you tell us what it's all about?
Yeah. So it's historical fiction. It's set in Middle America, 1939, and it is about a girl who joins up with a traveling carnival sideshow. And there's nothing, she's just a regular girl, which normally is a good thing in young adult fiction, like being normal. But in the context of a sideshow is not a good thing. It's actually a huge disadvantage because she's of no value to them. So she has to sort of find her place in this, this cast of characters. And it was incredibly fun to do the research for that book. And a lot of the sideshow performers are based on, real historical people.
So what did you, where did you do that research?
Largely at the Boston Public Library. They have a huge collection of circus and carnival memorabilia. I also took a couple trips to the P.T. Barnum Museum in Bridgeport, Connecticut, which is a really odd, funky, interesting little place.
It's like a sideshow.
Yes, it is. It is not unlike a sideshow. And the first time I ever went there, I was the only patron. I was the only person in the entire museum other than, you know, the like one or two people who were working there. So that was a pretty surreal experience.
What were some of those, the anecdotes or stories that you found there?
I had read a lot of circus fiction and had this sort of fascination with circuses and carnivals for a long time before I started working on the book. So I had a little bit of a sense already, but, things like, the Billboard magazine actually started as a newspaper for the entertainment industry back when the entertainment industry was circuses, carnivals, traveling musicians. And if there was a wedding, if there was going to be a wedding between two carnival performers, they would put an ad about it in Billboard. And that's how everyone would find out about it. And whoever could show up would show up. And so it's very different than the Billboard magazine we know now.
Tell us a little bit about the plot of the book.
Yeah. So Portia, who's the main character, is looking for her father. She's spent some time at a home for wayward girls, which is run by a very sort of gothic fairy tale villain kind of character, who's mostly just called Mister throughout the book. And she manages to run away and she follows this traveling carnival that has passed where she's staying. And she's using the carnival as a means to transport her from place to place as she looks for her dad. And then, you know, in the meantime, becomes kind of part of this family that is really unexpected for her. There's a really strong code of loyalty and social rules that are unique to a carnival family. And they look out for each other. And once you are part of that family, they will do pretty much anything to protect you. And it turns out that she really needs that from them.
Being, as you said, it was your first book, was that where you imagined your your first book would take place in this kind of traveling sideshow world?
It was something I had always wanted to write about. I drafted a couple of other things while I was in my MFA program at Vermont College. And I think my heart was, you know, I think those first other drafts were more like technical exercises. I was kind of figuring out, like, can I do this? Can I write a novel? I don't know. I've read so many, but how does this really work? And Wondershow was the first time I really kind of tapped into a world and a topic that I was truly, that my heart was really all the way in it. And that made it easier. That was a real lesson that, you know, if you don't believe and have a passion for what you're writing about, it's really hard to sustain the energy and the time and the love that you need to write an entire novel about it.
I'm curious about some of the parts of that book. Did you intend to write that for your, or why did you, I guess I could ask, why did you write it? And do you find that it's been helpful for people?
Yeah. So some of the parts came out of my own loss of my brother who died suddenly in 1999. And it took many years before I felt that I could write about that subject. The girl in the novel, Tally, is not really based on myself. I mean, she's a very different person than I am and than I was when I was going through that. But her emotional journey definitely mirrors what I experienced. So it was really therapeutic to write through that again and to revisit some of that. It was difficult, but it was very powerful. And what I've heard from readers of the book has also been a really powerful experience. That it is about it's really about her search for her brother's organ recipients. So his organs are donated when he died, and she's trying to sort of track down the people who are still carrying parts of him around that are alive in the world, and that becomes really important to her, but also kind of like an obsession. Mm-hmm. And so she's on her own, you know, she's feeling guilty. She has sort of survivor's guilt, and she's just trying to navigate as a teenager what it means to go on with the rest of your life without this person who's been so important to you.
Mm-hmm. Being that it is such a personal story, was it harder to be critical of the, you know, of the work that you're, of your work, to edit, to make decisions in general?
Yeah, I think there were things that were, so you asked before about the, how is the draft different than the finished book? In the early drafts of some of the parts, her brother was a character in the story. He was kind of visiting her. She was having like visions of him. And they were communicating with each other, and he was guiding her kind of along this search. And, the editor of the book, Melanie Cheka, said, you know, I think you need to take that out. It's really cutting into her agency as a character. And it means that she's not, she's just kind of following these breadcrumbs. She's not making her own decisions, which was a totally sound editorial critique. But it was really hard to agree to that because I felt like I was taking him out, you know, I was taking him away again. And so that was more painful than I thought it would be, but it definitely was what the book needed. It was what needed to happen.
And then just to change gears, because I don't want to short trip, whatever that word is, your picture books, please tell us about Bad Guys and Garcia and Coleco Exploring.
Okay. So publishing is a funny business, and that you're in so little control of the timeline. Like once you've written something and you hand it off to an editor, you know, picture books especially, it's usually about 2 years between when the manuscript is acquired by the publisher and when the book is published, because the illustrations take a long time, and the editor will, you know, engage in the search for an illustrator, and those people need time to get the art done, and there's a whole series of processes. So it's a long time between the story being done and the book being done, and some illustrators take longer than others. So Bad Guy and Garcia and Colette Go Exploring with two different publishing companies. They were not acquired that closely together, but they ended up being published just a couple months apart. It was kind of like having twins, but not at exactly the same time. And they're two very different stories, which I love, right? Because I can do, you know, story times with both of them, and there are kids in the audience who really respond to one or the other. And it is a great opportunity to talk to kids about how, you know, it's okay if you like this book better than this one. It's okay. You should be making, you know, your own choices about what you want to read. And not every book is for every person. And I love talking to kids about that and kind of empowering them to make their own decisions about what they feel drawn to. So Bad Guy is just really playful. It's about a little boy who likes to kind of pretend. He's very active and very engaged in his imagination and being all different kinds of bad guys. And his little sister is sort of the unwilling victim through most of the book, but then she manages to turn the tables on him at the end. There's a kind of an ongoing debate in children's publishing about boy books and girl books and how we use those terms and we don't want to, but we fall back on them a lot. But it's important, you know, we want boys to read books about girls and we want girls to read books about boys, and we hate those divisions. So the thing I love about Bad Guy is that it sort of looks like a boy book, but it actually is really has a really great empowering message for girls at the end. And then Garcia and Colette Go Exploring is much more of a sort of classic friendship story, parallel structure with two friends who want to go exploring but can't agree on where to go. So one of them is kind of obsessed with space and the other one is obsessed with deep sea exploration. And I find both of those fascinating, but
I was just going to say, tell us where that inspiration came from.
Oh, okay. So my husband works in the UVA graduate school, and he was invited to a dinner for prospective graduate students for the Jefferson Scholars Program. And I got to go along, and it was this very formal dinner, and I was seated between two prospective UVA PhD candidates. And one was an astronomer. And the other was, I think, applying for the political science program, but he said his real passion was oceanography. So I didn't get into why he was studying political science if his real passion was oceanography. That's another conversation, I guess. But
another picture book.
Yeah, maybe. So the two of them were talking about, you know, why they loved space and the ocean, and the things that they were saying, like, just sparked something in my head, like, you know, those two places are not that different, right? I mean, they seem really different, but they both have all these things in common. And I started making this mental list of, you know, they're dark and they're quiet and you have to have like special equipment to go there. And we don't really know what's in either of them at the extreme edges. And by the time I got home, I had this idea for a picture book. And once I drafted it, I mean, that it came together pretty quickly.
Well, thank you so much for being here, Hannah Barnaby. She can be heard throughout the Virginia Festival of the Book, correct?
Yes.
It's very easy to find that on that website, and they can have access to this very creative mind of yours. Will you be reading or talking?
I'm doing a lot of school visits, which I'm really excited about. Talking to kids in the Charlottesville City Schools. And
You teach before you guys. Yeah. You offer writing workshops. I mean, I know you know this. I'm just for the rest of the audience.
Yeah.
You offer writing workshops for kids K through 12, and you also teach adults at the Writer House.
Writer House is a nonprofit community writing center here in Charlottesville, and I teach picture book workshops and novel writing workshops and fiction of all kinds. So check out their schedule.
You've really got me actually thinking about that. Like, I love this. So thank you so much for being here, Hannah Barnaby.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah. Stick around. We'll chat.
Okay.
So, hi, Nance. You know what it's time for? What is it time for?
Please.
It's the palate cleanser. The palate cleanser music.
Groovy. I mean, maybe we should just call it Groovy Palate Cleanser. All right. I will get right to it, Ellen.
Okay.
MIT just created living plants that glow like a lamp. And why this is important is it's the first step, hopefully, in growing glowing trees to replace streetlights. Chemical engineers have injected specialized nanoparticles into leaves of a watercress plant, which cause it to give off a light for about 4 hours. This is like the same chemical process of a firefly. And what they're hoping is that roads of the future could be lit by glowing trees. And lighting apparently accounts for like 20% of the worldwide energy consumption, and this could really have an impact on cutting CO2 emissions.
Cool.
Can you imagine glowing trees?
Yeah, I know there's some glowing roadways, the blue phosphorescence kind of thing going on in a Scandinavian country, I thought. But that's so...
them.
Yeah, that's really cool. So mine is related to oceanography, as it happens. Did you know that there is an underwater post office in a place called Vanuatu?
No.
Yeah, it opened for business in 2003. It's situated within the Hideaway Island Marine Sanctuary. I don't know exactly. In the South Pacific is where it is. And every week, hundreds of postcards are dropped off at the underwater post office. And cruise ships come by and do that. And obviously the postcards are made out of plastic. Isn't that cool?
Wow. Yeah, I can't imagine. I mean, everything must be... I wonder how how adhesive works under water.
I didn't get to that part. No, there's...
Well,
it's like 160... Let's see, 160 feet down. But I don't know about
That explains everything to me.
I know, exactly.
Now it's crystal clear.
Actually, that's not true. It's not 160 feet down. Just forget that.
Well, listen, it doesn't matter to me.
Something.
I know
it's 160 feet off some other coast, an island nation from near Australia. So,
do you happen to know why they even did this? I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah, I know. I don't know why.
Yeah, okay. All right. Okay.
But I also wanted to say that some of the baseball teams, I thought you might know about this, are wearing caps for the high school where the shooting happened in Fort Lauderdale. Did you see that?
I saw the Yankees cap, and I didn't know actually that it more than they were doing it.
Yes.
But thank you for saying that. Yeah,
they're going to wear their actual caps with their logo from the high school. That was cool.
Right. Yes. In fact, the red and black, that makes, yes, I that's what, Detroit. I didn't notice. I guess they were. Anyway, thank you, Ellen.
We got to go. Thanks, Nance. Thanks, great guests, Cameron Webb and Hannah Barnaby. We'll see you next week. This is Apropos of Something, 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.